Call the next case.
Commonwealth versus Commonwealth Expo, Hunter Laboratories and Industries, Mark R. Herring, Attorney General, Pro Rata Prosecutor, Appellate Counsel, Matt Warren, Wyatt, Deputy Solicitor General, Kennington, Dasher, Assistant Attorney General, Bell, Matt Leifert, Assistant Attorney General, Appellate Counsel, Mark E. Friedlander, Jr., Eric J. Duser, Appellate Counsel.
You may proceed.
May it please the Court, Matt McGuire on behalf of the Commonwealth. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I may, this morning. When the General Assembly enacted the Virginia Fraud Against Taxpayers Act in 2002, it did so with the purpose of recovering fraudulently paid taxpayer money. To help maximize that recovery, the General Assembly permitted private individuals called relators to bring lawsuits on behalf of the Commonwealth. When a relator brings such a lawsuit, they are then entitled to a portion of the Commonwealth's recovery. Respondents in this case are relators who filed a complaint in Fairfax County Circuit Court under the Act, alleging Medicaid fraud by a particular company. The Commonwealth, relators, and the defendant agreed to settle the case for $1.25 million for conduct that occurred between November 1, 1997 and September 25, 2014. There are two issues of first impression really presented in this case to the Court this morning about how much money relators are entitled to collect under the Act. The first is how much of the $1.25 million is considered proceeds of the settlement agreement to the Commonwealth, and the second is whether relators are entitled to recover money for conduct that was released under the settlement agreement, but that occurred during approximately 5 years before the Act's effective date. Because proceeds in Code Section 8.01, 216.7b, mean money actually received by the Commonwealth to the benefit of the Commonwealth's taxpayers, and because the relators could not file a claim under the Virginia Fraud Against Taxpayers Act for conduct that predates the Act's January 1, 2003 effective date, the trial court should be reversed in this case and judgment entered in favor of the Commonwealth.
With respect, was the federal government a party to the settlement agreement?
No, Your Honor. The federal government has never been involved in this particular case at all. The relator here chose not to file both under the Virginia False Claims Act and our Fraud Against Taxpayers Act under the Federal False Claims Act.
So how do you deal with the fact that the trial judge's first blush, which is pretty persuasive on the face of it, is, well, proceeds under a settlement, one would think that's proceeds to the settling parties, not to somebody else.
Well, Your Honor, it's why the court has to look and why we posit that the word proceeds is ambiguous to a certain degree. It could plausibly mean what the trial court said it meant and what the relators say it meant, and it could also mean what the Commonwealth is suggesting that it means here. But you have to look at why it would be anomalous, really, in this case, to adopt the gross proceeds of the settlement agreement interpretation here. Because there are two sovereigns who participate in a jointly funded state and federal program like the Medicaid fraud context. And so while in an ordinary Virginia Fraud Against Taxpayers Act case outside of the Medicaid context, the entire amount of the settlement agreement would come to the Commonwealth. But inside the Medicaid program, approximately here it's about 40% of the settlement agreement is actually federal taxpayer money paid into Medicaid. And so under the Federal Medicaid Act, that's treated as an overpayment to the Commonwealth. And the federal government has determined that it is going to recover that money either as a remission from the Commonwealth to the federal government, or the federal government will withhold that amount of money from the Commonwealth as part of the Medicaid
program. But you can understand the instinct of a trial judge looking at that and saying, no, the way it normally works is you settle, you give the money to the other side, and if they have liens they got to pay off, or they've got contributions they've got to deal with, whatever, just handle it. Workers' comp liens, for example, the defense doesn't worry about any of that.
Well, we're not saying, Justice Kelsey, that it's not plausible to do what the trial court did here, but it leads to a very anomalous result in just this context, and actually imputes the General Assembly the intent of you wanted to treat Medicaid fraud recoveries differently than every other recovery under the Virginia Fraud Against Taxpayers Act, because it is only in this context, this jointly funded program context, where the Commonwealth
taxpayers... Does it impute anything to the General Assembly? This is just a settlement agreement between parties.
Well, it does, because it relieves the relators of their choice not to name the federal government. What's actually going to happen in this case is that the Commonwealth's taxpayers are going to pay the relators, the federal government's share of the money. The federal government is made whole. They free ride based on the relator's choice of litigation.
I get all that. Why didn't the AG just make a bad agreement based on some bad language? And they're stuck with it. What's wrong with that?
I'm not quite sure I followed the logic there, Justice Kelsey, only because the Commonwealth doesn't have a choice under the federal Medicaid program about how we can structure the settlement agreement. Every dollar that we recover in a Medicaid fraud action, a certain percentage of that is going to be paid back to the federal government.
Why couldn't AG have simply said, Proceeds, obviously, of the money that we keep after all this is over, not the money we get and then have to give away 40% of it. Why couldn't they just said that?
But it's plausible, Justice Kelsey, we could have drafted the agreement that way, but several responses. The first is the word proceeds is in the statutory text, so this court hasn't interpreted it yet, but will hopefully in this case to provide guidance on what proceeds means. But the second piece is that from all of the normal Medicaid fraud recoveries in all the federal courts, proceeds has always meant funds actually received by the federal government or the states. If you look at all the case law cited by the respondents here, all of that case law presupposes that the United States has received money or the state has received
money. I'm not disagreeing with anything you're saying. And if it went to a U.S. district judge or a trial court judge on the statute absent a settlement, they'd have to make that call. But the question in this case, and it sounds like I'm arguing against your position, but I'm testing it, really. The question is this settlement different? And is this just a one-off, poorly drafted agreement, and it got an ambiguous term got interpreted against probably the drafter, but who knows? And it has nothing to do with this statute. The statute can be interpreted completely differently than the settlement.
So, Justice Kelsey, the statute presupposes two options for how these Virginia Fraud Against Taxpayers Act claims are resolved. One is by award from the court. The other is by a settlement agreement. And in both contexts, the way the trial court read this was proceeds of the award means exactly that, a court award, but didn't attribute proceeds to the settlement. It's treating it as something different. But if you read the rest of the sentences, and shall be paid out of the proceeds responds both to what is in the settlement agreement as well as what would be in a tort judgment. And so there's no, although this case was resolved through a settlement agreement, there's no basis for treating the proceeds differently because it was stated in the settlement agreement versus being stated in a court judgment. In both cases, the Commonwealth is recovering a certain amount of money. And the question that we think the court should ask is how much of that money is actually coming into the Commonwealth for the purposes of the Commonwealth's taxpayers. To a certain extent, respondents characterize our position as being about gross proceeds versus net proceeds. But we don't think that's exactly the right way to look at it, and we didn't brief the issue that way. There are really two pots of gross proceeds in a case like this one. One that is the sovereign money for the federal taxpayers, and one that is the sovereign money for the state taxpayers. And in this context, what only thing that would have to happen for the relators to have a right to the money they wanted would have been to name the federal government. And it's really incumbent upon them when they bring the lawsuit to name all the parties to which they would like to recover. And so since the Commonwealth doesn't actually receive this portion of the money, and the Federal False Claims Act would have provided them a full remedy where if they had filed this lawsuit both under the Federal False Claims Act and the Virginia False Claims Act, they would have gotten all the money to which they were entitled.
Could the state have taken over the litigation and brought federal government in?
I don't believe we could have brought the federal government in. Justice Powell, we could have presumably alerted CMS to the fact that litigation existed. But the way these cases are filed is that the relator comes forward and files a complaint under seal, and then that goes to the relevant sovereign on whose behalf they filed the lawsuit.
So the relator has complete control over whether they sue just the state or both the state and the federal?
That's correct, Justice Powell. And so that was their litigation choice here. Now, the Commonwealth didn't decide to intervene in this lawsuit. That's really of no relevance here. The statute expressly contemplates a higher percentage of the proceeds that go to a relator when they pursue an action that the Commonwealth didn't intervene in. And the Commonwealth investigates all these lawsuits and investigated this one for quite some period of time before deciding not to intervene. But ultimately, the case was settled. And it's important to note, too, that the case could not have settled without the Commonwealth's signature. The Commonwealth has to agree to the settlement. They looked at the settlement in this case and revised it. And so there was active activity by the Commonwealth on all sides here.
Suppose during the settlement negotiations, someone said, look, we all know what proceeds are, right? It's under the statute. It's not just the check you cut in this case. No, I don't think that's the truth at all. I get 20% of the whole thing. No, it doesn't work that way. Then there'd be no settlement. The money would be paid in by the Quest defendants, and then the trial court, applying the statute, not a settlement, would determine the definition and scope of proceeds and then apply whatever the range of the percentage is to it. And everything you say would be indisputably accurate, I would accept prima facie, in that scenario. The whole question in the case, at least for me, is does it matter that you settled it and didn't say any of that?
Well, so Justice Kelsey, if you look at Joint Appendix page 133, subparagraph B, part 1, it goes into the fact that there was clearly contemplated dispute between the parties here about what did constitute the proceeds. Nobody has ever disputed that 28% was the applicable percentage. Everybody agreed that that was a fair amount of the proceeds. But what proceeds was disputed by the parties, which was expressly stated in the settlement agreement. And that was the basis for the initial motion filed in federal court. And we would submit that although that opinion has been vacated by the Fourth Circuit for lack of subject matter jurisdiction, it is instructive as just a piece of guidance on the issue of what one person thought. And it is helpful to understand how this works, and we think Judge Trenga got it right on the merits. So we would commend the court to look at his opinion in the case. But ultimately, because we think the word proceeds is subject to several different definitions, we think the court should pick the one that would be most consistent with the General Assembly's intent of recovering fraudulently taken monies from Virginia's taxpayers. Particularly in a case like this one, as we've discussed, the only harm really to relators is that they needed to name the federal government. The Federal False Claims Act contains almost the exact same provision about how they would have been entitled to a certain percentage of the proceeds had they done so. And adopting their interpretation really does lead to an anomalous result just in the context of these jointly funded programs, where if they're right, the relators here recover more money than the Commonwealth's taxpayers. And that won't be the case in any other situation.
But their argument would be we did all the work.
Well, that's true in any declined action case, Justice Pally, whether or not it's under a jointly funded program or not. And in those cases, they don't recover more than the Commonwealth. And the statutory scheme set out by the General Assembly expressly contemplates that the Commonwealth won't intervene in every action, and so they give extra, I think it's up to 5% of the proceeds to relators who choose to go forward. And it's important to note, too, and I really want to make this point clear, the Commonwealth does have a duty to investigate all of these cases, and that's why they're filed under seal, and the Commonwealth has 120 days to decide whether or not to intervene, and then they routinely request extensions to conduct a fulsome investigation.
Is there any meaning to be gleaned from the language in paragraph B of the settlement agreement? Paragraph A speaks of settlement amounts consisting of Virginia federal and state respective Medicaid portions, and then paragraph B provides that the plaintiffs will receive a percentage of the applicable proceeds. What does that mean?
So our position, Justice Powell, is that the state shall pay a percentage of the applicable proceeds in an amount to be negotiated. And so that contemplates, as I was responding to Justice Kelsey, that there was dispute about what the applicable amount of proceeds was. We didn't reach a negotiated resolution. It led to the motion filed by the Commonwealth in federal court asking for the federal court to determine whether the amount we have indisputably paid to the relators was the proper share.
So does applicable speak, I'm sorry, does applicable speak to state versus federal, or does it speak to 28% or something less? Or does it speak to anything?
It doesn't speak to 28%. The percentage has never been disputed. Applicable proceeds turns on the actual dispute in this case, where the relator's position is it's the entire amount listed in the settlement agreement, whereas the Commonwealth's position is it doesn't mean that because of that 40% of that money is not the property of the Commonwealth.
But where is 28% in this agreement?
It's not listed there, Justice Kelsey. It's just if you look at all the briefing in the case.
Well, I know they agreed to it eventually, but, I mean, if this were in any other context, we'd say this is an agreement to agree.
So, Your Honor, all I can posit here on the phrase is applicable proceeds and amount to be negotiated, the percentage of the applicable proceeds and amount to be negotiated. The Commonwealth and the relators agreed on 28%. They couldn't agree on what the word proceeds means under the Virginia False Claims Act.
But under your logic, if to be negotiated is not the percentage, which is unstated, which is the way I read it the first time, it's the proceeds. We got to negotiate what the proceeds will be. Well, that seems inconsistent, because if you got to negotiate it, it means we don't know, we're disagreeing as to what proceeds are. So how can it mean, plain meaning, that in fact it means exactly the way the statute would work as opposed to the way this settlement agreement is worded?
Justice Kelsey, the only two responses I have is that even if you read it as the percentage being also up for negotiation at that point in time, it has since been negotiated and been resolved on the meaning of the word proceeds, whether it carries a special definition under the settlement agreement. We don't think there's anything in the settlement agreement to suggest that it does, and that the better way to look at the case...
My question is the scope of proceeds what was to be negotiated?
Yes. The answer is yes.
But then how do you have a settlement agreement? I don't know how you've settled the case. This case is not settled.
Because Quest received its benefit, which was it wanted to pay a certain amount of money and to solve the claims against it, and then they left it to be essentially litigated between the relators and the Commonwealth about how much of that money was appropriate for the relators.
Well, then we're not dealing with a settlement agreement on that subject. We're dealing with basically interpleader fund and statutory rights available to it. So why are we even talking about a settlement agreement?
The only reason we're talking about the settlement agreement, Your Honor, is because that's the basis for the amount of money technically at issue here. The amount of money the relators ultimately get is some percentage of a maximum of $1.25 million, and that's the reason the settlement agreement is relevant from our perspective. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
May I ask a question before you sit down, Chief? It appears to me that the argument from the other side relies on 42 U.S. NCRC S1396B3A. And for the life of me, I cannot figure out what that means. I'm sure both of you all have already, but tell me what that means. It does talk about the net amount as if that has some relevance to how these proceeds are divided.
Trying to find exactly which statutory provision Your Honor is talking about. Because there are several provisions of 1396D2A or D3.
3A. The pro rata share to which the United States is equitably entitled is determined by the Secretary of the net amount recovered during any quarter.
So we don't have a position on what the net amount is, Justice Powell. What we have pointed the Court to as the critical feature of that statute is that as determined by the Secretary, the functional and the key piece of the federal statutory program is that the federal government decides for itself how much money it is entitled to, and its position has been for a long period of time that you calculate the federal government's share based on the total amount of settlement agreement. So 40% of that to them is considered the Medicaid overpayment. And once that determination is made, that's their entitlement under the settlement. They don't allow you to deduct the relator's share first or do anything else. They treat it as if they're entitled to be paid off the entire amount. And if you don't remit that amount, the federal government then has the right to withhold it from the state as a function of the Medicaid program. So whether or not the state pays it back, the federal government will just not pay that amount back to the Commonwealth. It's not in the record, but I can represent to you here that the Commonwealth has, with an agreement with CMS, held the money back currently, pending the outcome of this litigation to determine how this will play out. So the federal government has not yet been paid back in this case or withheld it from the Commonwealth, but that's just through agreement with the government.
I thought I read somewhere where the federal government provides like a 10% credit or something in the instance of a settlement. Is that correct?
Justice Goodwin, that's almost right. So under the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005, states get a 10% credit for what they're allowed to keep for fraud recoveries if they have a complying state False Claims Act, which means that it basically mirrors the federal False Claims Act. Only approximately 32 states have an act like Virginia's, and Virginia didn't have any mechanism for relators to bring a lawsuit like this until 2003. And so what happens is normally under the Medicaid program, half of the Medicaid dollars come from the federal government and half come from the state's taxpayers. But when you get into the fraud recoveries, if you have this state act, instead of having to pay the federal government 50% of the money back, the state's taxpayers get to keep an extra 10%.
So and that's here, what would happen here?
That's what would happen here. So the federal government's share of the $1.25 million is roughly 40%.
And the relator would get 28% of that.
We get 28% of the 60% retained by the Commonwealth. And if the Court agrees with all of our arguments, that would be the full amount the Commonwealth has already paid to the relators.
Thank you. May it please the Court, Mark Friedlander. I want to introduce Eric Buescher, Pro Hoc Vici, who will argue our position.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Eric Buescher. I represent Chris Rydell and Hunter Laboratories, who were the key TAM plaintiffs, or the relators, in the underlying Virginia Fraud Against Taxpayers Act lawsuit that they filed in 2007 in this case. The Virginia Fraud Against Taxpayers Act was designed, like the Federal False Claims Act and the False Claims Acts of roughly 30 other states, to allow private citizens to come forward to attempt to assist the government in recovering money that was wrongfully that it wrongfully paid or that an entity defrauded it of. The way that the Federal False Claims Act and the Virginia Fraud Against Taxpayers Act accomplished that goal is allowing private citizens to file and eventually prosecute lawsuits on behalf of the government.
Can I ask you this? The Commonwealth, if I've understood them correctly, is saying that the settlement agreement was an agreement to agree on the percentage. You had to negotiate that later. But it was also an agreement to agree on what you applied the percentage to, the proceeds. Well, do you agree with either or both of those, or with neither?
I think it was, in essence, in this case, an agreement to agree.
On both the percentage and the scope of the proceeds?
That is correct.
But then why don't you lose? Because if that's the case, we don't worry about this agreement or the intentionality of the contracting parties. In fact, we don't need to read it. We just need to read the statutes and determine what the statutes require.
So two responses on that, Your Honor. One, I don't think we lose because I think that the statute is read as gross proceeds, not net.
Okay, so you have to win the statutory argument.
Correct, and that is our first position.
Well, that is that different from the trial court? Because I read the trial court as basically making a gut call the way a lot of trial judges would, which is you sign the agreement, proceeds, money came in on the settlement agreement, it's a contract issue. But it's obviously not, under the concessions you all have made. It's not a contract issue at all, actually.
So the trial court looked at that and said that there's a distinction between proceeds of the award and settlement, right? It did not determine that proceeds under the statute.
There is no settlement on proceeds. That's the whole point.
And I think the second answer to your question, Your Honor, is that from a practical standpoint in these cases, that's often not the case. Because until we're in a situation like we're in now where our client has a dispute over the amount of money he is to receive from the Commonwealth, we are generally allied with the government in these trusts.
No, I'm with you, but now you've got to win the statutory argument. You can't just make the contract argument, which is, it doesn't matter what the statute says. We made a deal. The deal said proceeds. Money came from him to him. Those are the proceeds. And that's gone.
Well, I don't view those arguments as distinct. The proceeds, as defined in the settlement agreement, is $1.25 million in the settlement amount. That's at Joint Appendix 132. The agreement, the settlement amount, shall constitute a debt owing to the state subject to the terms of the agreement. And so the $1.25 million is what the defendant, the Quest defendants, agreed to pay the state to settle the lawsuit. Right. I don't view any distinction in that being the proceeds of a settlement as opposed to the proceeds as that term is defined.
So if there had been no settlement in this case, if the trial court had held $1,250,000 was the proper amount that should be paid in, you believe no settlement's on the table, but the judge should have awarded 28% on the entire amount, not just 60% of the entire amount.
That is exactly correct.
And the statute would have required that.
Correct. The statute requires a mandatory payment subject to some very limited exceptions that are not relevant here, where the key team plaintiff, for example, orchestrates the entire fraud. They then don't get a reward if they come forward later for doing so. But that's not an issue here. So it's a mandatory payment under the statute. And that mandatory payment is defined in a non-intervened case as shall be between 25 and 30% of the proceeds of the award or settlement. And so there because that payment is mandatory and is required by the statute, once we reach a settlement with the defendant, we know what the total proceeds are. And then there is a negotiation, usually resolved, sometimes adjudicated in court, between the QTAM plaintiff or the later and the government. If they can come to an agreement, these motions never get filed, these arguments never get made. We were able to agree that based on the contribution that the relator made to the action, which is the statutory standard under the Federal Act as well as the Virginia Fraud Against Taxpayers Act, that between 25 and 30%, 28 was the right number. The case didn't go all the way to trial.
Had you finished answering your question? If proceeds has no meaning separate from the entire amount of the settlement, why wouldn't the statute just read 20% of the award or settlement? Why would they need of the proceeds if it's 25% of what or whatever percentage of whatever amount you collect? Why wouldn't the statute just say percent of the award or settlement?
Your Honor, I don't have a good question for that. I think, though, that if you look at the difference between the Federal False Claims Act or the Virginia Fraud Against Taxpayers Act and the Medicaid statute, which you had asked about earlier, right there Congress writes the net amount recovered or the net amount as opposed to just this undefined or unqualified proceeds of the settlement. Right? And so the fact that they included proceeds, I don't think can be used as a conclusion or as a reason to conclude that that it necessarily is then modified further to be net proceeds or proceeds after all other payments or liens are made or after all other obligations are resolved.
Can we draw anything from anything from the fact that they use net in the Medicaid Act?
Absolutely, and there's two important things to be drawn from the Medicaid statute, 42 U.S.C. 1396 B.B.3a. And as Your Honor pointed out, The pro rata share to which the United States is entitled is the net amount recovered during any quarter by the state. Right? That clearly is an indication that the federal government, in creating its jointly funded program, understood that there would be times when the state would recover money as an overpayment or as a result of uncovering and prosecuting fraud, and that they would owe a portion of that back to be calculated based on the percentage of the contribution, based on whether there's a qualifying False Claims Act in that state, etc., but that it is the net amount recovered. It will cost the state money, or the state may incur other obligations in recovering those funds. And the statute, the federal statute, explicitly says the net amount recovered by the state. And the Commonwealth acknowledges here that they have not paid the money to the federal government. The federal government has not come to them and said, you didn't pay us enough, and we're going to withhold money in the future. None of that has happened. That risk is all hypothetical in this case.
Right, but your reading of the statute hasn't been nailed down. I mean, we're talking about this Alabama district court case that doesn't conclusively settle the issue and so on. So I'm not disputing that yours is a very plausible reading of the statute, but it doesn't sound like there's even a court of appeals case that says, yes, your reading is the right one, much less a U.S. Supreme Court case that settles the question.
I agree completely, Your Honor. There is a dearth of case law on this specific issue. We have found, I believe it is only two cases that sort of directly address this, one being the Alabama case, where they did what the Commonwealth could do here. Right? If the Commonwealth is ordered by this court or had agreed to pay the full 28% of $1.25 million and then went to the federal government and said, we have 72% of the $1.25 million left over, you get 40% of that. If the federal government said that's not enough, they could do exactly what Alabama did in that case and sue and say, the federal statute says net amount recovered, right? But you are correct. The only court that has even sort of touched on that issue is that Alabama court, which did not address it directly. The only other court we've been able to find, and we've been litigating this with the Commonwealth for 4 years now, is the D.C. Superior Court case, the Mills case that's mentioned in our briefing. Now, the Commonwealth says on reply that that case is distinguishable because it's not a jointly funded program. But if you look at the settlement agreement and the court's opinion in that case, there was money paid to the District of Columbia. It was a suit brought only under the district's False Claims Act, not the federal False Claims Act. There was money paid directly to the district. There was money paid to the Federal Department of Agriculture. And there was money paid to these nonprofits. And the district took the position, we didn't receive the money for the nonprofits. So that is not included in the proceeds of the settlement. The same position the Commonwealth takes here. And I think that the court in Mills offers a persuasive rationale for why to reject that position.
But of course, we have the U.S. District Court opinion in this case vacated on subject matter grounds, but that's as on point as going to get in terms of our case, because it is our case.
I agree, Your Honor. We think that Judge Trenga got it wrong. We appealed that up to the Fourth Circuit. The Fourth Circuit, sua sponte, asked for briefing on the jurisdictional matter. I think both us and the Commonwealth would have preferred that in the Fourth Circuit, and that we didn't spend two more years. But
here we are.
Here we are.
But Mills doesn't help you, does it? Because they specifically define which of these amounts of money will be included in their proceeds of the settlement action. And that $5 million to the nonprofits is specifically included in the definition.
It is. In
so that doesn't tell us what proceeds means for purposes of our statute.
From a contractual standpoint, that agreement was different than the agreement that we have here in terms of explicitly defining the $1.25 million. Now, I will point out, though, that again, the agreement here says that the agreement, the $1.25 million, shall constitute a debt owing to the state, right? And then so that is not as direct as the language in the Mills contract, and then you're correct about that.
But none of that matters because none of the contractual language has any application because the contract on exactly what we're talking about does not come to closure on the percentage or the proceeds.
Right, no, and this, the settlement agreement was the agreement with the defendant. We have not resolved with the state the amount of money that our client would receive under that agreement what is in the record before this court. The other thing that I would like to note, the Commonwealth argues that interpreting proceeds as gross proceeds as opposed to net proceeds would make Medicaid fraud a kind of a unique animal, and I think that's a red herring here. There are lots of jointly funded federal-state programs related to education, related to policing, related to medical expenses or health care. And the important thing to think about here is that if every time any QTAM plaintiff or potential QTAM plaintiff discovered Medicaid fraud, right, these are claims submitted by the defendant to the Commonwealth for services provided to the Commonwealth citizens under regulations drafted and enforced by the Commonwealth, if they submit claims, Medicaid-only claims, and that's the only thing you sue over, you don't have any claims submitted to the federal government to name the federal government as a party.
Can you answer me this? You're a sophisticated litigant in this kind of context. Why wasn't there an FTC count added? I mean, if it's in the record, of course. If it's not, don't mention it. But why wasn't there a federal claim made? It would have ended all this dispute. You wouldn't have to take any risk of having this debate later.
Because there are no claims under Medicaid submitted to the federal government. And we did not sue under Medicare claims or any other claims submitted to the federal government. At the time this was filed, and that's changed a little bit in the intervening years with some of the amendments to the False Claims Act that were part of the Affordable Care Act, the law under the False Claims Act and the Supreme Court's interpretation required claims to be submitted to the paying entity.
So at the time you initiated this litigation, you could not have filed a federal FTC count?
You cannot have a Medicaid claim filed under the federal False Claims Act. But when you have, as the Commonwealth points out, often you name both a state and the federal government. But those cases are the cases where you are suing over both Medicaid and Medicare dollars. And only if you are suing over Medicare dollars, where the claims are submitted to the federal government, to HHS, and then paid by the federal government, did you have an opportunity to name the federal government as a party or to file under the federal False Claims Act.
Even if you just sue under Medicaid, am I correct the government takes their 40% off the top?
The money is paid to the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth is then required to pay the federal government. Required. It's another mandatory payment.
And the relators are not entitled to any portion of the federal amount.
We are absolutely entitled to a
you
portion
are,
of
so
the
you
federal
get your 40%. You get your percentage
get
from
share.
The feds, and you want from the state based on the total amount. Is
we
that
get
the argument?
We our share from the total settlement payment, which was $1.25 million.
Okay, but that's not my question. My question is, you get a percentage of the amount that the federal government is paid from this 1.25, from the federal government?
No, we are asking for that money. That money was all paid to the Commonwealth. We are asking for the Commonwealth to pay 28% of all that money. What the Commonwealth then does in its relationship with the federal government in terms of paying 40% of what's left over, the net amount recovered, or 40% of the $1.25 million is going to be the Commonwealth's decision.
Could you ask for 28% of the 40% that's paid to the federal government from the federal government? Is there a process for doing that?
Without a False Claims Act provision allowing us to do so, I'm not sure there would be. I'm not aware of one now.
So the way this would normally work out, the way this will work out if you prevail, is the relators will get 28% of the $1.25 million. And then the federal government will get 40% of the no longer $1.25 million, and the Commonwealth will be left with some reduced amount.
The federal government would get its 40% from the net amount from whatever is left over. I'm out of time here. But that is true. The federal government would get, under our interpretation, 40% of roughly $900,000 as opposed to $1.25 million. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We're all out of time for both of you. Call the next case.
Virginia Electric and Power Company versus State Corporation Commission and others. Carrie Ann Jones III, Tennessee. lawyer of the